On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I've been trying to get my guest, now author and actor, Rainn Wilson, to do the show for a while, but between his schedule and my schedule, it's been kind of awful. He's here finally. Of course, we know him as Dwight from The Office. He managed to get Dwight to write the foreword to his terrific autobiography. The book is called The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy. And all those apply. First of all, Rainn, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Elvis. I'm glad I got to come down and sit in this basement with you.
Before we shutter this place for good. But one of the things I think is so wonderful about the book is it manages to be sensitive and funny so much at the same time. And at what point do you find that note was so easy for you to strike in the writing of it?
You know, when I was pitching the book, I told the editors, Dutton,
You mentioned quite prominently in the book of you.
Yes, because they were tied to the Nazis in a very interesting Bertelsmann used to be a Nazi publishing propaganda company, now owns half of the world's publishing. Anyway, I'm not going to go there. I told them, listen, it's going to be 85% funny and it's going to be 15% profound or trying to be profound. So, because something that was important for me to talk about in any book about me was a little bit of spirituality, a little bit of my life's journey, my artistic journey. This was an important part of my story, and I wanted to get it across. But mostly I wanted to make people laugh. And so hopefully there were some hilarious hijinks in there as well.
I think there are. But when you mentioned spirituality, you reminded me of one of my favorite sections of the book, I think in the Soul Pancake section, where you're talking to Ed Helms, comes up to you and says, I didn't know that creativity and spirituality could be the same, which I thought was kind of an amazingly profound thing to hear from somebody.
Yeah, but I think it's a very common thing. I think when people – the word spirituality, it's a disgusting word. I hate even using it. I know that half the people listening to this interview right now heard the word spirituality and went, ugh.
Well, you go into a kind of a big definition of what spirituality is and why that word turns so many people off in the book.
Yeah, I do. Because it either usually for most people means fundamentalist religion, A, or B, this kind of like airy-fairy, hippy-dippy, kind of really vague, Oprah-esque kind of – feeling, gooey feeling.
And also a lack of commitment, which is what you really get at in this.
Yep. And a lack of commitment of like, oh, I get spirituality from this yoga class or from this tree that's in my backyard or from this crystal that I look at that's on my shelf. And so it is a very vague thing. So the intertwining of spirituality and creativity, to me, I see as the same thing. They're from the same source. That's the human impulse to create, to transcend our mere physical condition, to yearn for something greater, to strive, to serve, to create something beautiful, that those are both impulses that come from spirituality and creativity.
It really is, and it's something I think that kind of goes through the book a lot, although you don't explicitly state it really, and that's the search for the divine.
It was certainly my life's quest. You know, I grew up a member of the Baha'i faith and left it hard in my 20s when I moved to New York City to become an artist and be a bohemian and be an atheist. And I didn't have any room in my life for God or spirituality or devotion or morality or anything like that. I was in Greenwich Village, damn it, and I was going to be an artist, come hell or high water. And then as I found myself increasingly unhappy through my 20s, even though I was working as an actor, which I thought was a miracle that this weird suburban kid from Seattle could be working as an actor and working with some great theater directors, but it wasn't enough and I was deeply unsatisfied. And so that began kind of my lifelong quest for the divine. And you're right, the spiritual impulse and the creative impulse both can be looked at as a quest for the divine, you know, whether it's Jackson Pollock or whether it's Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel.
I think, though, it's funny you're talking about Broadway, and one of the things that so often I think happens in Epiphany came from your failure. your failure on Broadway.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit, because it sounded like it was this perfect thing for you. And by sort of eschewing spirituality and trying to force yourself into this, what you call actor man guys, you ended up failing because of that.
Yeah. And that was something I highly recommend that everyone write their memoir or their autobiography, even if you haven't been playing a ridiculous character on a TV show for a decade. Because you learn a ton. And one of the things that I really learned was how much I grew from my failures and how integral my big failures were in my life to make me who I am and to give me later successes. So I got cast in this Broadway show. It was a restoration comedy from kind of a post-Shakespeare era. It was at the Roundabout Theater. It was a big production. There were a lot of big kind of theater stars in it.
So this is the point where you were really kind of like foundering and looking for this one big thing that was going to define you as an artist.
Yeah, I was looking for my place as an artist. I was looking for my place spiritually. I didn't know what I thought or felt or believed at that same time. But I thought, oh, this is my meal ticket. I'll get a great New York Times review, and I'll get a Tony nomination, and agents will come out and want to put me in Coen Brothers movies, and I'll be, this is it. This is my, and so all that pressure and kind of some misguided ideas I had in my own head about what it meant to be an actor, I sucked. I sucked in the play. I was terrible. And I cried through the middle of the night and wept to my wife on the phone and really struggled. And I was tense and sweaty and muscular and just all wrong for this part in every way, shape, and form. And really bombed. But going through that, I came out the other side and I vowed, you know what? I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to be someone else's idea of who I am as an actor. I have to be myself in my work. And I really reached out to God during that time and felt like I found a connection to my higher power through that experience. And when I look back at it now, like, I never would have played Dwight had I not bombed on Broadway, because I probably still would have been doing theater. It's what eventually kind of drove me to come to LA and try doing some more comedy stuff. And by embracing who I am as a person and an artist, the geeky, awkward, normal, schlubby self of who I am, that allowed me to kind of find Dwight and play him successfully, I feel.
I think some other things too, because being someone who spends a lot of time in hotel rooms, I end up catching a lot of weird stuff on TV and having to catch you during your soap opera phase. And what I remember is you were so vivid, because everybody else seemed to be sleepwalking, especially Santiago. When you talk about the tantrum he threw out, really, he had that much energy because he never showed it on any episode of the series.
That's hysterical.
And just, you really popped on that. And just one of those things that sort of struck
me. You're one of the world's renowned film cineast critics. And you spend your secret time in hotel rooms watching soap operas, Elvis Mitchell?
It's not secret. At some point, it's either, you know, the ABC Family Channel with Pat Robertson is on, or you turn on One Life to Live, and there you are.
No, it's true. That guy who played, I forget his name, but it was my first on-camera job, One Life to Live. I played Casey Keegan, the homicidal stand-up comic, of course, and the lead guy on the soap opera threw a big tantrum and was literally kicking furniture and set pieces over and like swearing up a storm. And the producers came down and we took like 3 hours off. And I kind of thought, oh, this is what happens on film and TV sets. I've seen Sunset Boulevard and some of these other, you know, I saw Roger Rabbit and that happened there. You know, this was what I thought happened in the big world of Hollywood.
My guest, who apparently is shocked that people read his book, is Rainn Wilson. His book is a wonderful autobiography, is The Bassoon King. I think I was also kind of struck, too, by the chapter in which you enumerate how you got seduced into playing something you call a collection of Lincoln Logs and used paper towel rolls.
The bassoon itself. Yeah, I got kind of roped into that by my high school band teacher.
Who had the greatest name of any teacher ever?
John Law. Actual name. John Law. Johnny Law. I fought the law and the law won by getting me to play the bassoon. I wanted to play the saxophone.
Be one of those cool guys in sunglasses.
And yeah.
What's really interesting is that, and in a really kind of, I think, thoughtful way, you touch on the fact that for a long time, maybe until this century, bullying was just an accepted norm.
Yeah. It was considered healthy, really. When I grew up, like, kids would get their lights punched out and tortured and teased if you were different. And even the teachers would get in on it. The teachers would be like, "Ah, that guy is so dorky, deserves to get the crap beat out of him." You know, there was a very, it was like, "It'll toughen him up. It's good for you." There was that underneath it. And it really, it's just not. It's really so not good for you in any way. But it's so great how that's changed. Like at my son's school, if there's anyone teasing anyone, you know, online or otherwise, like it's the, they bring the hammer down, you know, and there is just, it is not tolerated. And I think that's a great thing.
Well, one of the other great things too is in the, and you have a number of lists in the book, we should say. And one of the lists is the 10 things I know, and that your son is your sensei.
Yeah, yeah. 10 things I know for sure is this great Oprah challenge that she always does. And I was excited to do it. It's actually hard to find 10 things that you know for sure. But one of them, yeah, my son is my sensei. That my son is 11 now. Like, I've just learned so much watching him grow and interact with the world and come into who he is. And it's helped me kind of get back to my inner child in a way, just seeing him flower.
Well, there's a connection, I think, between him and Kid President, whom you also helped to really put out there, and that he has that same kind of leaning forward, looking forward to enjoying every day of life.
Yep. Yeah, my son is very, he's bright, and he's a bright ray of sunshine in this dark world. And that's similar to Kid President, who was a piece of talent we found on Soul Pancake, which is this media company that I founded that is mostly known for its YouTube channel, but we do a lot of other work. And
including interviews you've done on
there. Interviews on there. Metaphysical Milkshake, I call it. It's an interview series in the back of my van. But yeah, Kid President, a piece of talent that we found, this wonderful young kid from Tennessee who just makes the world a better place. And he's just a bright ray of sunshine. And we were looking for more joy on our channel, on Soul Pancake, because our whole purpose of our media company is to uplift people and get them talking and bring them together. We're a mission-driven company to kind of explore the human condition and help make the world a better place. And Kid President fit the bill to a T.
Because one of the things that runs through the book, and again, it's not really stated, but it's pretty implicit, is that you respond throughout the book in any way to enthusiasm. I mean, that's always clearly something that, you know, your dad's enthusiasm of writing those novels or just the way that John Law talked to you into playing that bassoon. I mean, anybody who has enthusiasm is something you connect to immediately, isn't it?
I think I'm a naturally enthusiastic person. And when you – now I'm almost 50 and you go through the ringer of life, it's very easy to become cynical. It's very easy to become pessimistic. Enthusiasm – I used to know what that meant in the Latin.
Yeah, so did I.
But now I can't. I'm blanking on it. But it comes from that same creative, transcendent impulse, I think, to be enthused, you know, to be on fire for something, to have passion for something. I mean, I try. I don't try very successfully, but it's definitely something I respond to.
No, sure. That's pretty easy to see. And I just thought it was really interesting because you get to reflect a little bit in the book on Backstrom, who I thought was kind of the perfect character for you to play, right back to taking to your hometown sort of to play the character.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I just thought that chapter, because I really wanted to see what was going to happen with that guy too, because I loved that show and that group of actors. I mean, it's a really disparate group of actors who everybody had a character part rather than a lead part, including you.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, it was short-lived series on Fox there. We did 13 episodes, and I thought it was a terrific show, too. People that actually watched it really enjoyed it.
You get to work with Robert Forster, for goodness sakes.
He was my dad, Robert Forster. He was my hero. Oh, my gosh, I loved him, man. The Black Hole, right?
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, from way back in the day. So that was really cool, and Hart Hansen, the creator, is a terrific guy and writer. But, yeah, that was an interesting journey because he was such a foul-mouthed, despicable human being, so bitter and closed off. But we were going to get to dig into some really juicy stuff of how did he get that way and how does he get out. It was ultimately a redemption tale. So it was a tricky thing to ask of an audience as well in a crime show to say, we're going to take this really despicable, dark, bitter character and you're going to go on a journey with him over several years where he finds himself and he finds his place in the world. slowly, and he has some fallbacks and some stumbles and some...
But in some ways, like you, somebody who really respects enthusiasm and competence,
yep.
That character.
Yep, that's true. Wow, I hadn't... You're really good at connecting all these dots.
We'll take a break so I can connect some more dots. And in the meantime, my guest is the author of The Bassoon King, but you know him best as Dwight from The Office. You should know him from many other things. It's, my guest, of course, is Rainn Wilson. It's The Treatment this morning. Come stay with us.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm sitting with the author of The Bassoon King, and you know him as an actor, of course, Rainn Wilson. We were talking a little bit before the break, I guess, about the search for spirituality and enthusiasm. And I think you found it in one of the most unlikely of places when you got to go and spend time doing incredible work in Haiti. And there's a section of the book I want you to read that speaks to that.
Okay, here goes. You all know the story of Sean Penn and his work in Haiti after the quake. It's indescribable what the man was able to do. Love him or hate him, the facts are that Sean formed JPHRO and saved thousands of lives, built tens of thousands of shelters, cleared hundreds of tons of rubble, and distributed medicine and hope throughout the country. Even now, the organization continues its amazing work and has single-handedly transformed a huge segment of the capital. 6 months after the quake, Holiday, my wife, and I were invited to JPHRO to do some arts workshops with adolescent girls in the tent camps as part of a program sponsored by the United Nations and Full Circle Learning. I was allowed to tag along and teach, but I was quietly skeptical. Why would adolescent girls without jobs, shoes, roofs, or food benefit from doing drama, photography, creative writing, and visual arts? They needed job training and pants and fresh water, not theater games, poetry, and pretty pictures. Boy, was I wrong. The girls came in shy, insecure, timid, and filled with fear. Teenage boys from the surrounding tents gathered around the, quote, community center that had been built for us, a 20-foot by 20-foot mud patch surrounded by a wood fence and a straw roof, with chickens, pigs, and naked babies running around under our feet, and jealously jeered as the girls filed in to do the work. One of the most eye-opening experiences was when we asked the girls some personal questions about themselves in a simple getting-to-know-you exercise. One of the questions was, "What is your favorite color?" With the boys leaning in over the fence, the girls were shame-faced and quiet. As they attempted to answer, we had a powerful realization. No one had ever asked them what their favorite color was before.
That's a remarkable thing to me because, first of all, it speaks to me about your responding to that thing, that spark in them, the need to be awakened, that, and which we get to see flower, which you got to see flower in your time there, didn't you?
In that first 2 weeks workshop that we did with them, they transformed. From the moment they came in, these shy, I say shame-faced girls, girls are just treated as just workers in Haiti. They boil the water and take care of the kids and fetch the food and sell in the markets and clean, and they're put to work when they're 9 years old. And by the end, when they were showing their photographs and doing their theater and singing their songs and reading their creative writing and their poetry, they had transformed into young women, and it was beautiful and powerful. And so that started Holiday and I, my wife and I, to found L'Idée, a nonprofit in Haiti. Right now we're doing the same work with almost 500 girls in rural Haiti. And it's been really exciting to be a part of.
And you get to see, too, that they respond to enthusiasm as well, don't they?
They do. They get to respond to that when they are told, when they are showed that they're important, that people want to listen to them and people care and care about what they create and about their souls and who they are. They flower and come to life. And that really begins their educational journey more than just giving them a bunch of textbooks and math exercises and reading exercises. If they don't believe in themselves, how can they learn?
And this gets back to me that looking for something transcendent, something bigger than you, looking for the divine, that's even a part of this too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think education is the key to unlocking, I guess you'd call it, the divine in all of us. You can look at it in different ways. Yeah, education unlocks people's potential and the potential to give back. Arts education gives people a voice. It did for me. I'm sure it did for you as well. I had some great teachers who believed in me, who saw a spark in me. I've been able to have a really rich, fruitful, amazing life with some great experiences because of it, and I just want to share that.
I don't want people to think, though, that the book is, I mean, because there's so many colorations in the book, and I guess I laughed at the part where you reveal your inner theater snob, because one of my favorite sections, too, at the very beginning is when you and Dwight have a conversation about your favorite TV characters. And these are all these sort of sad clowns who the thing they all shared in common, and I think the thing you responded to, because I get it out of you as well, is an incredible sense of timing that they all had, all these guys.
Mm.
From Les Nessman to one of my favorites, Howard Borden on the old Bob Newhart show.
Right.
To Jim Ignatowski on Taxi. They all had the oddest timing. Or David Landau. I mean, all these guys that you really dug.
Yeah.
All these actors who, and you go into great detail about what you responded to in Landau, who, you know, if you put that guy in Taxi Driver, he'd be Travis Bickle. He'd be a psychopath.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. That's true. Yeah, there's a section on comic character sidekicks because I had such a weird and disjointed and alienated family. I was pretty much raised, like much of America was in the 70s, by my television set. And those comedy families are what raised me, and I loved those secondary comic characters. They were just magical to me. So the fact that 20, 30 years later, I got to play a great, strange comic sidekick character was just absolutely a dream come true, beyond my wildest dreams.
But I think the thing that, for me, works for Dwight and connects him to all those guys is in playing him, and it's interesting to read you going on about being able to really build a character by, in effect, creating the first blog for a fictional character in history, in television history. You really got to figure out who and what Dwight was. But still, all that work aside, it's all about the timing of Dwight, who almost always seemed to be either 2 seconds ahead or 5 seconds behind.
That's very well put. Well, I was certainly aided in the timing by some great writing and, of course, working with Steve Carell. He's no slouch. So
the sweaty Steve Carell.
the very sweaty Steve Carell, yes. The poor man and his sweat glands. You know, and working with that great ensemble certainly helped.
But still, I just wondered, because you write about your admiration for the original Office, which was its own thing, the BBC Office. But a small thing, a very, very small thing. And one of the things you get at, which I think is really smart about what great American TV does, it creates this long lifeline that the British shows don't have the challenge of doing.
Right. Yeah, British shows inexplicably can do 6 episodes a year or 13. Or
remind people how many episodes of The Office did, the original
Office. The original Office did 13 episodes total. We would do 13 in 3 months. We did 202 episodes. So it was a very different beast. So comparing the shows is I go into that in great detail as well. But I think part of it, too, is in my theater training, I did a lot of clowning. And clowning is all about
timing.
Basically
came out to L.A. to create a clown troupe.
Yes, the new Bozina. We brought a clown troupe out here. That was my first trip out to L.A. And that kind of opened a bunch of doors. And that was fantastic. But clowning is all about timing. You know, it's all about the rhythm of the character and the rhythm of the character in the world and that comedic timing. So I view Dwight as a clown character. You could put a red nose on him and he'd be the self-serious clown, you know. You could put him in a Cirque du Soleil show. In fact, they should do that. Are you listening, Cirque du Soleil?
Let's not.
I want your new show to be Dwighticus. I'll wear spandex and wear a red nose. There you have
My
it.
Guest is pitching a horribly plausible idea is Rainn Wilson. His book is The Bassoon King. But I think, though, that timing, and I just wonder where it came from for you, for Dwight, that idea that he's completely out of time with everybody else.
You know, it was something that Greg Daniels, the show creator, said to me very early on, which is that, you know, Dwight has his clan, the Schrutes, and they have their own way of looking at the world. And I think great acting, I'm not going to say I'm doing great acting, but what you strive to do in acting is you strive to see the world through the character's eyes entirely. So that's all I wanted to do as Dwight, is see the world through his eyes. So it's kind of like in The Terminator, when those little options would come up for Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is like, you know, blow his head off, see you later, hasta la vista, baby, or whatever, and he could choose those things. That kind of thing was happening with Dwight all the time. So he was not like smooth and organic and capable of like natural human interaction, which, by the way, is also something I struggle with, being smooth and organic and having smooth human interaction. I share this with Dwight. People ask me all the time, what do you have in common with Dwight? I would say I see myself as an outsider.
What it gets back to is believability. I mean, because you even mentioned a couple of times offhanded references to sort of the classic TV sidekicks who came in with a shtick, and these 10 characters that you enumerate in that list, which you comment on with Dwight, who apparently misses the point of all those guys, is that they're all believable people.
Yeah. That's what I love as well, is how much absurdity can you bring and at the same time how much believability. And that balance is where I think great comedy lives, in kind of maximum absurdity and maximum believability and just riding that line. And it was, you know, sorry to get all fancy on your ass, but it's very Anton Chekhov. You know, it's very Chekhov of these absurd characters that you really, they're heart-achingly real at the same time.
And you now have a play you're working on yourself.
Yeah, I'm doing a play. I'm doing a one-person show that was written by this great New York playwright named Will Eno. He's been a friend of mine for a long, long time. It's called Tom Paine, Based on Nothing. And it's at the Geffen. And it's a very profound and peculiar piece of theater. It's a man coming out in front of an audience, and he talks at that audience for about 68 minutes. And it's poetic and it's comedic. And he's in terrible pain and trying to make sense of his life. And he uses the audience. It's also very interactive with the audience at the same time. It's a very strange piece of theater. It's not a one-person show of like FDR sitting in his wheelchair by a fireplace talking about the Battle of Normandy or whatever. It's not that kind of one-person show. And it's also not a one-person show of, you know, written by the person who tells stories of their life growing up. It's almost like a Samuel Beckett meets stand-up comedy.
Wow. But you've got me thinking because, again, too, what you said in describing the play is it really is an interactive piece. So it's about feeling the energy in the room and inviting people to be part of that with you, which is when you're really doing it, it's a different show every night, isn't it?
It really is. And that's why I really believe that. I know you come from the film side of things, but I think the greatest artistic experiences I've ever had have been in a theater. That being said, there's nothing worse than bad theater. Bad theater is so much worse than even the worst film.
Well, you actually mentioned a character in the book and the movie I happen to really like, that if you flipped it 3 degrees, it would be comedy, but in fact it's not, and that's the lead in Super.
That was maybe my greatest film experience that I got to do. James Gunn wrote and directed it. He of course, did Guardians of the Galaxy last year. And you spoke about Taxi Driver. It's Taxi Driver as a... It's Travis Bickle as a superhero.
But it's also that horrible thing, well, what it would be like if superheroes are actually hitting people with wrenches.
And, yeah.
I mean, you feel the physical impact of all the violence.
The consequences of that, of blood and violence and the vigilantism behind being a, quote, superhero. But it does it with a tremendous amount of comedy and heart, too. It's a great film. I'm very proud of it.
Thanks so much for doing this, Rain. Really, thank you.
Thanks, Elvis.
The book, again, is called what?
The Bassoon King, and My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy.
And the play is?
The play is at the Geffen Playhouse in Westwood here in L.A., and it runs from January 8th through February 14th, and it's Tom Paine, Based on Nothing.
My guest, who was almost named after one of the victors of the Peloponnesian Wars, is Rain Wilson. His book is The Bassoon King. Recording engineer who also mixes the show is Kat Yords, edited by my associate producer, Blake Veit. I don't play a bassoon by any way, mean, or fashion. It's the treatment.
To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.